These are the bibliophiles of the night.
Can you read it? Can you read it?
The structuralists. The postmodernists. The lip loggers. The Lizzies. The jaded New York Times book critics.
I think it's time to put literary fiction out of our lives.
And these are the readers.
Excuse me, sir, you have some outstanding overdue fees.
Shut up! Caught behind 27 shelves of signed first editions. Between them and safety lie 20,000 merciless and highly unforgiving librarians. The readers' sworn enemies.
I want them all! I want all the readers!
They just want to get home and curl up with a good book.
Readers, come out to play.
The Readers, with director Walter Hill, coming soon with theater near you.
From one Lizzie to a different sort of Lizzie. Kids, this is Bat Segundo, and I'll keep this short. Our first guest, we have two of them today, is Lizzie Skernick. She's a teacher, a writer, an editor, a blogger. She wears many hats, and most recently, she's shown that she's a poet. Her new book, Check-In, is available from Clue Train Press. Now, I haven't a clue as to how to order it, but let's just say that I have a good deal of awkward experience with trains. Anyway, our young roving correspondent talked with Miss Skernick about all this stuff and more, and revealed a few unexpected personal details in the process.
So, I am here with the wonderful, the immortal, the erstwhile, not the erstwhile, actually.
Yeah, I'm Wile.
The Wile, Lizzie Skernick, who is here to talk about her book, Check-In. How are you doing, Lizzie?
I'm doing great.
So, why poetry? What is the deal with poetry? If I want to go ahead and adopt myself as a stand-up comic there.
Yeah. That's a very big question to start off with.
Well, I want to give you the general ones, and we'll get to the interesting ones later. So.
Right. I don't think poetry is ever a choice. And I think even, you know, when it's not a choice, it can still often be very bad. But if you make a choice to write poetry, you know, then it's definitely going to be bad. But, I just always had lots of rhymes in my head ever since I was 7, and I used to hand in my book reports in metered verse. And
really?
Yeah, I think most poets, I mean, I think most poets have a slightly, I'm totally exaggerating and probably not saying anything that's actually true, but I do think most poets have a little mania and also the part of their brain that, you know, rhymes and, you know, sort of has fun with words is slightly more antic than it is in other people. Like, for instance, if I can't remember the name of something, I always remember something that rhymes, or something, you know, that's almost sort of the name of something. And I don't know anyone else that does that. Just suggest my brain just likes to think in rhymes.
Okay, looks like someone's trying to call me, but hell with them. speaking,
they're probably bored.
Yeah, they want to talk to me at this hour. Speaking of forms, I note that in this book you actually tackle a lot of meters. You have Villanelle Noir, which is this noir tale in Villanelle style.
Yeah.
Then there's the Randy Six Men Sestina.
Yeah.
Now, to what extent are your poems exercises in becoming acquainted with a form?
Those, actually, to tell you the truth, and I'm glad it was so obvious that they were exercises. Those were exercises because I wrote them when I was a much younger poet and still experimenting with form. And actually, it's funny, the only good thing about them being exercises is that usually it's like gambling.
Mm-hmm.
You know how you always win money at gambling right away and then you never win for the rest of the night. You know, when you first try a form, actually, you usually get some exciting results and then the next 40 poems are terrible. So those, you know, those were just some first tries that had one or two redeeming qualities.
Well, I was shocked that there weren't any Spenserian stanzas.
Yeah, I don't
You got something against the Fairy Queen?
I didn't enjoy reading the Fairy Queen, and I didn't want to revisit it. No, I mean, Spenserian stanzas are kind of hard to render. You know, I guess it's always sort of the task of the contemporary poet just to not sound like an ass when they're using any sort of a form. And Spenserian stanzas, I don't know, but maybe now I'll try it, Ed.
Maybe you have a prejudice against the Alexandrian, I don't know.
Yeah. just a little, probably. I have a prejudice against anything that requires way too much work and doesn't seem that fun.
Oh, okay. Well, you were mentioning earlier that these early exercises in form were when you were much younger. So how many years does this collection encapsulate?
Well, actually, there's a few. This is, I really shouldn't admit this, but there's, and I hope you can't tell which ones they are, there's really a few that I wrote in college.
Oh, okay.
So it's 10 years. Most of them I wrote in graduate school and thereafter, and a few I just wrote, you know, when I was sort of a young girl working in publishing in New York. But it really takes a very long time to get a poetry collection published, unless you're very lucky or unless you work at the New Yorker. So, you know, I guess probably from start to finish, I wrote these up until I was about 26 or 28. And then, I mean, I wrote a lot of other poems too. And then, you know, tried to get them published for a few years. And it was actually a longer book at one time, but I decided that about 20% of them were sort of semi-mediocre. Mm. And I took them out. And then the book got published much more quickly.
No, I didn't notice an acknowledgments page in this. Did these appear anywhere else, any of these poems? Or?
Yeah, they did. There actually should be a page right in the front.
Oh, maybe I missed it. Where is the book? The book has disappeared, but I'll take your word for it.
You didn't read the book at all.
I did read the work because, oh, I'll tell you, because the husband poems, for example, these... Yeah. I have to say that the poem, My Husband Was a Broker at Bear Stearns, and the opening line, Nothing Makes Me Tenser Than Masturbating. I mean, I thought I was the only person who got high blood pressure every time I jerked off, so, you know.
character, Ed. It's not me.
Okay, okay. Well, anyway, okay. Well, maybe I revealed too much there, but how do the husband poems come to be?
Those actually have a good story, and maybe I should make my life a little bit more stressful in order to write my next book, which is that I was dating a married man at the time.
Ooh.
Yeah, but don't get me. He was in a modernist marriage, so everyone.
Oh, okay.
It's just that I was very young, so I was the only stupid one. But
that's interesting. Well, I'll tell you more after this, but
okay.
off the mic.
Okay. So anyway, and so I was living in Baltimore at the time, and he was living in New York, and our encounters, you know, over the course of about 6 months just made me so filled with rage that I would be driving back going 80 miles an hour, you know, down the New Jersey Turnpike, and actually, on an unrelated note, I almost lost my license, but
whoa.
I guess my brain was kind of in an obsessive state, and the poems just started coming to me. And I would write them down. It was really bad. I would write them down as I was driving. And I remember the first one I wrote kind of like on the back of a Harper's, you know, and I sort of just stuck it up by the wheel and kind of wrote as I was looking ahead, which you can kind of do. It's not the safest thing in the world.
Wait, so you're telling me you were writing poetry while you were driving?
I actually write a lot while I'm driving.
Really?
Yeah.
Do the local police know this?
Yeah, they all have a pen alert.
Yeah, they've got actually you up on a post office somewhere. Poet who drives and writes.
Right.
Worse than drunk drivers, really, you know.
Yeah, well, I write while looking straight ahead. I've always felt like the thing, if you're going to do something really unsafe while you're driving, as long as you actually keep your eye on the road and you're willing to drop whatever you're doing, you're pretty safe. At least that's how I rationalize it. But, yeah, I do that. I write a lot just before I go to sleep. You know, any time it's really inconvenient is when my brain likes to sort of deliver lines to me.
Well, I was curious also about the poem Tyringham, 1998?
Yeah, Tyringham.
Tyringham. Okay. Oh, I misspelled it in my question list. Oh, Tyringham.
So Tyringham is really much more...
Interesting, actually. Well, I mean, I'm a Californian, and so the East Coast is this sort of interesting, exotic land for me, almost a mystery. And I Googled Tearingham.
Tearingham.
Like, thank you. See, I need to be edumacated here.
Yes.
And I found that this was a town in Massachusetts that had been inhabited by Shakers. And you also mentioned that Horace was involved. And I know that Horace actually predated the Shakers. So I'm wondering where this poem came to be. What's up with Tearingham? And do help a native Californian out here.
Oh, God. See, once again, it all comes back to my ex-boyfriend who is married and my general laziness, which is that, you know, sometimes when you can't think of a title for a poem, you know, it's the sort of lazy ways to just put the place where you wrote it and the year or, you know, whatever, the sort of psychological space being represented by a physical place. But anyway, so I just was there that summer, with my married ex-boyfriend, who's going to kill me that I talked about him so much in this, she ever listens to it, but syllabic, yeah. But that also it was a poem, you know, the Horace's, you know, poems are usually sort of about a lover, you know, often a lover who's, you know, flipping through your fingers in some terrifying way, so that was really the only reason he was mentioned there.
You use the first-person voice quite a lot in this collection. To what extent would you say that you are a personal poet, or is this a way to kind of break out of the first-person plural you use on the blog?
Yeah, no, the blog came later. I was just imitating Alex there, probably. I always wanted to speak in the royal we, though.
Yeah, even I've become, unfortunately, seduced by it myself. So.
Well, I will drop the royal we if you will drop weigh in. But you know I want all the male bloggers to stop saying weigh in. It's like my personal quest.
Wait, weigh in? What?
Weigh in. You know, I'm going to weigh in.
Oh, I got you. Okay. Well, you know, that's actually, weighing in is, yeah, I mean, it sounds like I'm going to be, you know, in my junior high school wrestling or something.
Yeah, I always picture everyone elbowing each other out of the way to go sit at a table. It's really terrible, but it sort of cracks me up also. But, what were we talking about?
Oh, yeah, the first-person voice in your poems.
Oh, yeah, I think that's because, you know, I do think, for the most part, the book you write in your 20s, and I actually think this should be the book you write in your 20s, because the people that don't write this book are a little psycho, is usually about love. You know, sometimes a poem comes and you're like, all right, I'm going to have to manipulate you a lot to make you acceptable. but these seem to come, you know, hand in hand with a very deep feeling. And it's true that I always tell my students really to ignore their feelings, because it doesn't mean anything is good. And I think that's actually mostly true. But actually, I think maybe feeling is the wrong word. They came with a pretty strong sense of seeming secure in their sound, and I didn't want to fuss around with them too much.
And it was easier, perhaps, to write in the first-person voice?
Well, it's not easier, I guess. It's just how I'm really like a slave to my poems. I mean, I'm really, really like a very lazy poet, which I think is why they sort of have a lot of wordplay, because they come that way. And I find, I mean, people probably think they're bad already, but the more sort of muscle I put into my poems, the worse they get, which doesn't mean I don't work on them. I mean, I do take them through probably about 70 drafts each. But even as I take them through the draft...
70 drafts?
Like 70.
Wow.
But, you know, with the teeny little changes, but all in all, it really winds up being a lot, like anywhere from like 30 to 70. But even still, I'm never kind of consciously forcing anything, you know. I just kind of, you know, let the lines come. And, you know, the good thing about that is, you know, when you're good, you're good. And the bad thing is, you know, when they're not coming, you just wind up, you know, writing a lot of crap. But that's actually why poets use form, or at least it's why I really embrace form.
Now, I'm wondering if Numbers was inspired by Amy Bender's An Invisible Sign of her own?
Because... No, and I actually... No, and I did, let's see, was that a story or was that one of the collections?
No, actually, that's the novel she wrote, and it's basically, there's a lot of reverence for Numbers. It's about this young woman who becomes this math teacher, and, you know, there's an invisible hospital, but more importantly... there's this interesting sort of obsession with numbers.
Oh, yeah. I think I read a part of that. I actually liked... It's funny. Well, don't put this because she'll... Well, if she ever listens to it. But I really loved her early work, which I sort of... I think I caught some of it in Granta and the Paris Review. And then this last book, I haven't liked any of it. But
Willful Creatures?
It seems almost not even like her.
We're talking Willful Creatures, right?
Yeah.
Really?
I mean, the stories that I've picked up here and there seem really, like, prosaic, and it's just not as kind of inventive and really kind of wonderful as her early stuff. But no, I think a lot of...
But what about the story written in the first person plural? You didn't like that?
I'm not sure I read that one.
Oh, it's really good. Yeah, it's sort of like an interesting, I think, development for her. She goes into this... It's basically this girl... who was bullying other girls in school, and then years later she runs into the same girl as a woman, and she refers to herself in the we, and she can't sort of get over the past, but there's also this implication that she is maybe suffering from some sort of multiple personality disorder. It appeared in Black Clock, and it's really good.
Maybe I should read that one.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I love that. That was my favorite story in the collection. And the name escapes me, unfortunately. So
the ones I read seem mostly about, you know, like having a boyfriend you didn't like and being sort of drunk and depressed, which is nothing wrong with.
Yeah.
You know, I already write poems like that, so I see it in another writer.
Yeah.
But no, it wasn't inspired by that. I think... a lot of writers sort of suffer from synesthesia all the time, just like in a mild form. And I have no memory of why I was thinking of Numbers and their personality at that particular moment. I wrote that one at a writer's conference. But something, someone... I actually... Another bad place where I write is during readings and during class. Like, actually, when I was in college, I was taking a very big poetry seminar, and I would always write a poem during the class, and then I would show them to the teacher after, and he would get kind of pissed off because it wasn't like a workshop. I'm sure someone just said something during the reading that prompted that train of thought, and then I wrote that poem. But no, I've always thought, Numbers had personalities, and actually my friend Laura Lippman, I think she has an essay on her site about letters having personalities, and it's, furniture having personalities is always a big thing in, fiction. So, yeah, it was really just that.
Huh. Well, I have to ask, are the rocks in Angel Eyes a reference perhaps to Marlowe's A Passionate Shepherd to His Love, the poem that is taught in almost every sort of English class? Because personally, I feel that rocks are sort of extremely uncomfortable to sort of woo someone or to make love. And Marlowe, I think, was dead wrong about the romantic appeal of rocks. So I was wondering why rocks appear in that poem at all. And they also appear in Grand Central.
Yeah, that's true, actually. No, the rocks in Angel Eyes are just totally literal.
Okay, well.
And anything else was just, my subconscious having fun. Let's see, rocks appear in Grand Central Track 23. I'm not sure why they would appear. Where are the rocks there?
The laureled, relentless rocks on Grand Central Track 23.
The laurels, relentless...
Fourth stanza, first line.
I thought that was clocks.
No, it's rocks, but it's the laureled, relentless rocks, the sceptered row of columns, dreams 1 o'clock immense.
Oh, yeah, what rocks are those? Jesus, that's a good question.
Well, yeah.
I think they're the rocks because that's a poem about taking the train back to college. And I think because of the laurel that's probably, it's either a reference, see, I'm very literal. You know, I'm really never talking about anything except for trying.
Don't tell our listeners that.
Yeah, I know. There's
all sorts of meaning. I found the meaning. You could find.
Yeah, it's like the cigar is not even a cigar. It's just a cigarette that I smoked that I was actually smoking. It's just boring. But, yeah, I think it was actually probably a reference to the ivy clinging to rocks at the school. And I think probably my brain also just made a little wordplay and made it laurels because it was also talking about sort of the laurels of academia. I mean, that's all I can think. I'm just glad you weren't in my workshop questioning me on why the hell the rocks were laurels, because laurel really probably doesn't grow on rocks, and I would have been better off saying vines, but laurel sounded better.
Well, you know, at the same time, there is a comma. You saved yourself because there's a comma between laureled and relentless. So
right.
It could be the laureled and then relentless rocks.
Yes.
So that sort of saves you there. Subconsciously you had an escape mechanism there. So
you get a little bit of my royalties from now on.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I was interested in me was the in My Husband is the Husband of Five Other Women, there was a painter named Meta. Now, I was curious about the name. Did you know any painters who sort of regularly refer to themselves or something? Or
No. It was her name. I think it's an Israeli name.
Oh, okay.
But it wasn't the name of someone I knew then, but it was the name of someone. I mean, I might have even stolen it from a book. But it's funny, though, because all of my poems, now that I've been doing so many readings, I realize that I have all these words that I find incredibly hard to pronounce and that I wrote and that I'm really not even sure how to pronounce, like whether, you know, you pronounce that name Meta or Meta or Meta or,
you know, Meta
or Beerus. I mean, I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong left and right. And so I did one reading where I really realized that I must say Iranian 900 times in this book. Lord knows why. And I said, Iranian, Iranian, you know, it's ridiculous. I was like a newscaster on Fox, but, so.
Well, there's a lot of names, actually, throughout all these poems. Where do these names come from?
They're just, probably just that they fit well syllabically. They're just the names that sort of come, and then if a name comes in, it's not an actual name. I try to find a name that fits. I mean, actually, you know, when I'm writing, I don't know if other poets do this, but you know, I'll sort of write, you know, the clock that stops in, you know, and then I'll say, I want it to rhyme with, you know, Rabelais or something. And so I'll write that in there. But that's not the word I want. And then later I just find whatever word works well with that I probably wanted. And sometimes it's that my brain is just trying to think of a word and I can't. And sometimes it's that I can't think. I mean, something that I found is that I would write down the word and my handwriting would be so bad that I couldn't read it, but prompted by the bad handwriting, trying to think of the word, I would find a better word to go there. So I'm sure some of the names come from that, you know, where, you know, I meant a million, but then somehow putting William in there.
Do you have any particular names that stick out? I know that for me, like, I'm a big fan of Enrique for some strange reason. It sounds so nice, you know.
Right.
Or Phil is frequently used by me.
I like Phil.
Isn't Phil a great name? It's like, not only that, but it's such a cheesy name, but at the same time, it's not, you know. It's.
No, I really like Phil. I used to go for Lily and Jane a lot, but I think those have, like, pretty much...
Oh, Bobby Sue and all that jazz.
And there was some name that someone always kept insisting was my real boyfriend, and I Barry.
I don't know why I find Barry funny.
I bet he kept insisting that because he found it funny.
Every Barry I have ever met has been extremely dubious. I have no idea why. It's just something about Barrys.
Well, I have a female friend, Barry, who's very nice, but she's like Peter Barry, so it's very different.
Oh, okay. Well, the other, I wanted to go off of more motifs that I sort of located here, and I know that you meant them to be these really sort of disingenuous deals, but... for example,
there are a lot of strangers within these poems. You've got Inside Out and many of the husband poems. Why are you so interested in strangers?
Oh my God, I have no idea. probably because, probably not for an interesting reason, probably just because I was feeling alienated, I'm sure. I mean, whenever a stranger shows up, you know, that's really all it means. I mean, a stranger really never bodes well.
A lot of those strangers have a sort of dangerous yet kind of fun quality, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, that's true. A stranger can also be fun. That's yeah. True. I wasn't thinking of it in the San Francisco sense.
Oh, well, you know, we are all strangers here in this town, and I was wondering how you managed to balance, or you almost write in several different voices. You're a poet, you're a lip blogger, you're a New York Times book review critic, you're a YA writer. Now,
right.
What does your hat rack look like? How do you balance all the hats?
It looks like a bouquet.
Yes! You should open up a hat store, you know?
Yeah, it looks like a hat store. Yeah, see, I was trying to be visual, but it didn't work out. I just like writing in all those voices. You know, my day job is, you know, at Girls Life magazine in Baltimore, and really I spend all day, you know, writing copy about, you know, how to keep, you know, your feet from stinking and, you know, how to keep your hair, you know, nice in the winter. And, you know, when we do our little copy for here's a giveaway for a book, you know, I really like writing that. I mean, luckily, I think you just, you know, have a talent for certain voices, and you just have to work with what you have. And again, you know, I really wish I had a talent for, you know, sort of deep, serious literary fiction. I mean, I wish I could be like Justin Cronin or, you know, Jhumpa Lahiri. I always mispronounce her name. But, you know, I wish I could write that kind of quiet, you know, serious, you know, very affecting fiction, and I just can't at all. So it's just, you know, what I can do well, I try to do.
But certainly Tannen House kind of gets you serious there for all those reviews you wrote.
Yeah, although those are not, those are more angry than serious. No, yeah, no, they are serious, but I guess that actually also, it kind of comes automatically. You know, that you know, when you see a book, and even, you know, that I don't like to use the word creative process, but when I read a book and when I'm getting ready to review it, you know, as I read it, I'm kind of taking notes, and, you know, themes, you know, sort of come to me, and sometimes the opening line for the review comes to me, and, you know, the things I'd like to discuss and the sort of thrust of the review really sort of come to me. And I don't, you know, sit down and intellectually try to pick apart, you know, what I want to write about with this book. I mean, I do that later after I've kind of marked out the things I find interesting. I'm not saying I don't put any kind of a conscious thought into it all, because I put a lot. But I do think if I didn't, if I weren't automatically inclined to create an opinion about how well something had worked or not worked, and the mechanic, you know, therein, and, you know, what happened with the voice, you know, the fact that the voice kind of tails off. You know, I mean, that's really why I started the blog in the first place, which is just that, and I'm sure why you started the blog and why most bloggers start their blogs, is that you just kind of have a conversation going on in your head about something, and you'd like to share it because it's really a conversation. It's not, you know, just a thought you have, you know, like, oh, you know, that dress is ugly, which is not anything anyone needs to share.
But I don't know. Also, though, I find this, and I think you might find this, but I think the internet sort of encourages all these false identities. I mean, I certainly play around with a lot of that and have a lot of fun with it, and I know you do too. I don't know why that is. Maybe it's the conversational feel, or the fact that you can be anonymous even though you're not, you know?
Right. No, I mean, and actually that's true, and I have about like 5 blogs going now, like 80 of which are secret, and
ooh.
I know, but they're not interesting. I mean, some of them are secret just because they're boring, you know? But I do think it encourages that, but really just because it's very easy, not because people have split personalities, but it's very easy, for instance, you know, to have, it's sort of another kind of a form, to take our last, earlier in the conversation, you have your blog that's focused on your dumb boss. You have your blog that's about your internal frustrations, written wittily. You have your blog about your internal frustrations that's not written wittily at all and that you don't want anyone to see. You have your blog sort of dancing around, your discussion of literary fiction. And people do. I mean, I always think it's funny because I go see my therapist and I'm this, boring, weeping person that's not saying anything interesting. And then I go home and, sort of laugh and dance around on the blog. And I think, most people are like that. I think it's that the blogging software makes it much easier to do it with very pretty fonts, versus, going out and becoming a concert pianist and an actor and, a bricklayer, which kind of takes a lot of work. Not that what we do is, nothing, but I think it's just that, you can create a new blog or blog so easily that, there's no reason why not to. I mean, I think Eurotrash, I don't know if she's keeping it up, but she had a funny blog that was just things she'd overheard that morning.
Oh, yeah, I remember this. In fact, that sort of seems to be a common theme. There's like the SFist in my neck of the woods is starting to do that, too.
Yeah, and those blogs are great. I mean, they're like, I can't remember what the movie was called, but it's that movie. It's one of the, I think it's maybe in Smoke, but it might be in the other one that Paul Auster wrote.
Oh, The Blue in the Face?
Yeah, but I think it's in Smoke. I can't remember, but it has the character, Harvey Keitel, who, takes a picture in the morning outside of his shop every day.
Yeah, that's Smoke.
Yeah, that's Smoke. And, it's blogs are great for that. If you want to just focus on one small thing. And I think the blogs I had no idea that I had this whole thing about blogs being formal. But, frankly, the blogs that focus are the best. Even if you have to have 80 blogs, that focus, and Nick Denton has really profited off of that. But
yeah.
But it's true. It's really great to have a blog that can sort of slide along in one track, versus wandering all over the field.
My battery's about to die, so I'm gonna have to ask you one final question.
Okay.
You said.
Sorry, I didn't mean to run down.
Again. Oh no! Actually, it's my fault entirely because I should have replaced the battery, but. It's now blinking at me saying, I will die. But I was wondering if you set any limits upon yourself as a writer, whether as a blogger or whether anywhere. You alluded to secret places, which it's interesting to me that they are actually public in some very vague sense. Because I mean, I keep a journal myself, and that's kind of my, I can write anything here and don't have to worry about being found. You know what I mean?
Right.
So in what sense do you set limits for yourself?
Well, I really don't, and it's funny, it's just in the AWP Chronicle, I was just reading, I can't remember which poet just wrote a whole piece about writing about his family and, his father never speaking to him again. I don't write about my family because they're all still alive and there are about 300 of them, and I really can't. I mean, I get a complete psychological block about doing it, and I remember when I was younger, there was a writer, sort of my friend's mother, who said she had, reams of notebooks where she'd written that were really about her family stories that she was just never going to publish. And I can't even write them. I just won't. I don't want to because the people are too real to me. I mean, they're right there. I can't write about someone and then go have lunch with them. I feel a little bit less protective of, my friends and obviously my lovers and, certainly other people in my life, but I'm struggling all the time with the fact that I don't really like to write about people I know, which is probably a bad thing for a writer because most of your writing really, even if it doesn't emerge in that form, it is, spawned by interactions with people you know. So
it's interesting you mention that because I talked to Tom Boyle about this where he was saying that under certain circumstances, he would not, write about people he knew.
Right.
But then again, sometimes he would. But for the most part, there was this really interesting kind of ethical idea that he felt the need to pretty much stick with his own imagination for the most part, and whatever sort of personal experiences and fiction or whatever he had read sort of kind of was mixed together in this very incredible stew, and he's incredibly prolific, you know?
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, I just can't. I really wish I could. I wish I were just like, yeah, fuck it, you know, bad luck for you that, you know, I'm...
bad luck that you met me.
But, you know, I mean, I know Michael Chabon does that. That's his whole shtick, which is totally fine.
Oh, don't even get it started on I yell it, you know? I yell it, rather. Lizzie Skirnick, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
It was a pleasure.
It seems that our young roving correspondent can't stop chatting with literary ladies, for there is a second guest on this week's show. Her name is Wendy Lesser. She's the editor of the Three Penny Review and most recently the author of her first novel, The Pagoda in the Garden. Now, I don't know what a pagoda is, and I've never seen a garden, but I understand that this is an allusion to Henry James. Anyway, our young roving correspondent talked with Miss Lesser, and I don't think he's any the lesser for it.
So I am here with Wendy Lesser. How are you today?
Fine.
And we're here in the Three Penny Review office while Wendy is in town, her normal residence, but not quite right, to promote her book, The Pagoda in the Garden. Now, I wanted to know, this is your first novel. How
yes.
did this actually start and come about?
Well, I have written fiction since I was in my early 20s, just mm-hmm. like most people who are interested in writing and who read a lot of fiction, as I do. But several novels ended up in drawers because they were clearly not good enough. And this one, pieces of it began in, I would say, the late 1970s, and I just worked on it for 20 years.
Really? So it goes back that far?
Huh? Yeah. And then I had it in what I thought was a pretty close to finished condition, and I showed it to my agent. She thought it was fine. I sent it around to editor. She sent it around to editors. That was in around 1999 or 2000, and we collected about a dozen very warm and nice rejection slips from New York publishers. So I stuck it back in a drawer, and then Colm Tóibín published The Master. Have you read that?
Unfortunately,
it's really good.
I really want to though.
Yeah, it's really good, and I was talking on the phone to Cynthia Ozick about it, and she thought it was really good, too. And mm-hmm. I said, the only thing that really annoys me is that he used the story of the Smiths, mm-hmm. these servants that Henry James had, which I had only read in a letter of Henry James. And I said, I used them in this novel I wrote years ago and stuffed in a drawer.
Yeah.
And now he's used it, and I can never publish the novel. And she said, nonsense. Ride his coattails. And yeah. I thought, you know, I'm going to give that a try. And I took it out of the drawer, and I sent it to the guy who runs Hansel Books, who's named Harry Thomas, mm-hmm. and he took it in a week. He retitled it. The Pagoda in the Garden is his title, which is a really good title, I think.
Comes from the Golden Bowl.
It comes from the Golden Bowl, right, and which is nowhere directly alluded to in there, but I do allude to the Chinese pagoda in Kew Gardens.
Yes, it actually sort of appears, as it were.
It appears at the beginning and the end, yeah. So I thought it was a great title and kind of represented a lot of what I was trying to do in the novel. And I've been really happy with the way they brought it out. So far it's good.
Well, I will come back to Henry James in just a minute. But basically, the novel itself, it was very interesting to me because you call this a novel in three parts. And there is some connection between the three various stories that they both all deal with American expatriates. Henry James is profiled in all three of them. But say a particularly stingy grad student would say, no, that's not a novel, that's three novellas. How would you actually answer to that?
I would say, you're right. You know, what can I say? I mean, it is three novellas, but then so is Michael Cunningham's Specimen Days, which just came out. And if you really wanted to be picky, you could say The Hours was, although there the three stories are interwoven.
Yeah.
But it is three separate stories and the characters.
David Mitchell's work, you know, there you go.
So I think these borderline categories are occurring more and more now of mm-hmm. things that people are writing that actually in the olden days would have been published as three novellas, that's it. Now, mm-hmm. if someone chooses to call it a novel because there's enough connection, they can get away with it. I mean, it's not new that something like this goes on. There are examples of it in short story form, like Winesburg, Ohio, mm-hmm. Sherwood Anderson's linked stories, or even The Dead, Joyce's book of short stories, there's a link in Dubliners, you know, not the dead, Dubliners, you know, so that characters are sort of acquainted with each other in them. But I agree, there's not a huge amount of overlap between the three stories.
Well, with that in mind, and, you know, right now what we're seeing, something very interesting in fiction where people want, I guess novels are more marketable now than short fiction. The Atlantic has done away with its fiction. And since you are a person who specializes in short fiction, then how do you think short fiction will survive? How do you think that, must it be packaged as a novel in three parts or three sort of novellas that are actually really is a novel, that kind of thing?
I wouldn't say I specialize in short fiction and that this is the only work of fiction I've ever published. Yeah. So it just, I happen to have done this one. I do publish short stories in Three Penny Review, not my own. Yes. I don't actually write short stories at this point. Although, I did when I was young, but none of them were any good. I don't think short fiction is going to die. I think it's fallen on commercial hard times, but so is the novel, for that matter.
Yeah.
And the novel that's any good. I was really pleased to see that when Philip Gurevich relaunched the Paris Review, he emphasized that it published fiction. And he is a nonfiction writer, and he... you know, has worked for The New Yorker for many years, but he chose fiction as the thing he talked about in the interviews, and when he put on an event at the New York Public Library, he chose two fiction writers from the magazine. And I thought, that's great, that a guy who is not a fiction writer will say, fiction is still important, and it needs to be kept alive because it can say things that nonfiction can't. So I think that because fiction is going to stay alive, the short story form is just a form that a lot of people choose to write because... they don't have the time to sit down and do a whole novel.
All three parts feature American expatriates, and James himself was an American expatriate. I'm curious how much of these expatriates were inspired by James's work, or how much of it was drawn from your own sort of peripatetic nature? I mean, because you're, after all, gallivanting, it seems, from New York to Oakland.
And I did live in Cambridge, England for 2 years.
Aha! Uh-huh. I was going to ask you that, too.
Part three comes very, very much from my experience. It's all been fictionalized to the extent that the original of Paul, who read this book before it was published, because I figured I didn't want it to be a shock to him when it came out, you know, 30 years later to see himself caricatured as a fictional character.
Yeah.
He said he found it very moving. He thought I had given his point of view more weight and mine less than they deserved in reality and all that. So, but it was very much drawn from real life. At certain points he would say, did that happen? My memory must be failing. And I would say, no, it's fiction. I made it up. But, you know, so that third section.
I was wondering why the narrator or the protagonist, rather, didn't have a name, I noticed.
Right.
I was going to ask you that. So.
She partly
whether her
name
might be Wendy.
Well, she partly doesn't have a name because the Henry James character in the first section thinks about his nameless narrator.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'll make this her his nameless narrator in some way. But also just because you do think of yourself as without a name, you know, as this kind of blank, anonymous I. And if you write it in third person, then it's she. And so that's how I ended up doing it.
Yeah.
The James part of it, the early 20th century part that's 1901 and then 1926, that's drawn a lot from James's life, a little from Edith Wharton's. If there is a model for Charlotte, it's Edith Wharton. But Edith Wharton has been fictionalized much more than James.
Yeah.
The James parts are pretty true to him, except he never lived just outside Cambridge. He lived in Lamb House, which was farther out in the country in a slightly different direction.
Yes.
That was inspired very much by James, by caring about James's novels and by reading his letters and by feeling that James had partly been responsible for why I cared about England when I went there 75 years later. Mm-hmm. So that's basically why the first part's James. And the middle part is not based on anybody I know in any way. 1956 seemed to me to be a good middle point. It was a very interesting year for England and America. I mean, it was the Suez Crisis in England. The movie The Entertainer was made then. I don't know if you've ever seen that wonderful Olivier movie of the John Osborne play.
I haven't, and I love John Osborne.
Yeah, and a lot of interesting theater about the change in England was being done then. And England was just beginning to emerge from its post-war self.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was also the end of the McCarthy era in America, and there were a lot of Americans in England who had fled the McCarthy era, particularly in the film industry. That part I got from friends who I knew whose parents were in that situation. But the rest I just made up, and I had to sort of check facts, because the 1901 part, nobody's alive to know, you know, well, they didn't have airing closets then or whatever. And and I did historical research, and I knew enough about the period to try and get it right. But the 1956, people are still alive who knew what things were like then, and so I checked as much as possible what they were like before writing that part.
Okay. Well, the other thing that's interesting in all three stories is that you reference presidents during their particular time. And it struck me that the parallels between Calvin Coolidge and Eisenhower and Nixon were very similar to a certain sort of currently who's currently in power. Was that the intention, or did that have kind of just magically sort of happen?
Magically, because the book was completely finished by 1999, at which point, you know, God forbid, I could not have imagined
Prescience.
That George W. would be president. Yeah. It was copy edited or edited. That is, Harry Thomas is a very good line editor, and he went through and he gave me, you know, 10 single space pages of suggestions about things like, well, do you really think Roderick would have been that explicit to Charlotte in talking about such and such? He had gotten inside the characters and gave me advice from that point of view, but nothing to do with making it more contemporary or anything like that. So none of those kinds of changes were made, and it only bears out the point I was trying to make, which is history is continuous so and cyclical, and you know, we go through the things over again.
So the president, you would say, is a common reference point.
Well, it is a way that Americans tend to date themselves in history. You do. There are certain presidents that you know what they look like because you saw them on television yourself, or their picture in a newspaper, and others that occurred before your life and you don't really know them in the same way.
Did you face, when you were doing the historical research for 1901, did you face any sort of problems trying to, I guess, get the certain kinds of human behavior that is repeated in the various three sections? What sort of problems did you possibly face when you sort of did the, you know?
None, in the sense that I had read...
like there's the, for example, the interesting thing that I was fascinated by, for example, the whole sort of the servants.
Yes.
And the relation, the class distinction, and how this was somewhat different from what was normal in terms of the 1901 section. The question here I have is certain sort of folkways kind of loosened up, and people were able to, like, you know, not necessarily subscribe by a specific sartorial code or anything like that. I'm wondering how much of this was sort of a factor in trying to, in terms of either hiding the cycles or profiling them a little bit further? Did you face any kind of restriction? Or?
No, not that I was aware of. I didn't actually. A lot of what seems to be echoes among the three parts came out in the course of the writing. Mm. That is, I didn't set out to do programmatically this kind of relationship among people in each section. It's just that when I wrote about the way things were, that came out. James really did have a servant situation exactly like that. Yeah. People who were drunk or mentally ill or whatever, and who he had depended on and hadn't noticed until it was brutally called to his attention. There really was a bedmaker when I was at Cambridge. In fact, until the second to the last draft of this book, her name was Dolly, which was her real name. And I was going through the proofs and I thought, oh my God, I've left her with her real name. This is terrible.
Oh, wow.
And I changed her to Edie after Edith Wharton.
Well, now she knows for sure. I'll have to, what, want me to bleep that part out?
Yeah, I know. She probably, if she's still alive, because she was already very old then, probably doesn't focus in on the internet, would be my guess. But the way things were in 1901 is I've done it to the best of my ability based on everything I know about the period, which is a lot of history reading, a lot of novel reading, and reading biographies and letters of Henry James and Edith Wharton. Edith Wharton did have a lover who was younger than she was, and Henry James did have a young man who he was quite interested in who was a sculptor, and nobody quite knows what went on there sexually. You know, so all of that stuff is not made up. It's not the present superimposed on the past. It's the past the way it was, just written about slightly more explicitly than Henry James would have done it.
I want to sort of go to the nature of cyclical sort of behavior, as that is repeated in this and that is repeated throughout history. And I think that there's a quote I actually found by an author named Philip Klass. He's a science fiction writer. He's a professor who writes under the name William Tenn. And I dug this up completely by accident, but I thought it might be pertinent in light of this interview. I was wondering what you had to say. He had this to say in 1975. I think we live in the freest goddamn time in the history of man. Insanely free time. There are freedoms now that I never thought would have been available. Just the kind of language I can use, and I wish the things I could write about. And this, of all criticisms of our society, so far as I'm concerned, is the ultimate freedom to date. We are the only society that is examining itself in an open way, that is constantly trying to improve itself. Then he goes on to say, and these freedoms will probably be ditched in your lifetimes. I think the pendulum swings, and in very few, in very short periods of history, has man been free. Now, I was curious, in light of this quote, to what extent have you seen freedoms transform through the course of your life? And if so, did any of these kind of make their way into the freedoms you were potentially examining in the Pagoda and the Garden?
Boy, that's a big question. And yes. Let me first say, it's very pertinent of you to have quoted a science fiction writer, because from about 14 to 17, I read nothing but science fiction. I read lots of science fiction. And most people would not detect any of that in here. You know, I mean, I didn't detect any of that when I was writing this. Yeah. But now that you mention this, I see that something about that science fiction reading has invaded this notion of time travel.
Yes.
And all science fiction, pretty much, is premised on the notion that the writer is really writing about his own time in the guise of writing about some other time or planet or whatever else. That is over and over again what they're doing.
Yeah.
So I must have pretty much kind of absorbed that and thought I was doing that in the 1901 and 1956 parts too. As for whether I personally have seen freedoms come and go, yes, for sure. I mean, in another book, I wrote a book about rereading called Nothing Remains the Same, and I reread books that I had read when I was in my 20s and younger. And in the part about Dostoevsky, I started out by saying, when I first read The Idiot, we lived in a period that was like this, and it listed characteristics of the period, and it included people did not worry that they were going to contract the fatal disease when they had sex. That utterly altered the face of sexual behavior, really. I mean, that you went from having curable penicillin-type diseases to AIDS. That completely altered the face of sexual behavior. The whole rise of religion also has altered that. Needless to say, the fact that Bush is president has altered that. I mean, those freedoms we all have seen go away in the last few years. Absolutely. Freedom of speech type freedoms and free sort of privacy freedoms. On the other hand, things have also moved in the other direction. When I was a young woman, abortion was illegal. Mm-hmm. So Roe v. Wade is it since I came of age? Just barely, you know, basically about the same time I came of age. The freedom to swear publicly is much more common now. I mean, The New Yorker uses words it never would have used. Television uses words it never would have used. I remember I was with a friend who doesn't watch television. I wanted to watch The Sopranos. I turned it on. He walked through the room and he said, "Oh my God, they say that kind of thing on television now."
Well, it's HBO though. So.
Yeah, it was. But still, that's a big breakthrough in that way. And the freedom to publish what you think in the forum of the internet or little zines or any of those things, that kind of freedom has always existed in a very small scale form, like samizdat in the Soviet Union or manuscript periodicals that Diderot sent around to the, you know, eight heads of state that he wanted to inform about what was going on in 18th century France. But the scale of it, the fact that you can reach hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people through your own little talking about whatever you want to, that's new. And that's a freedom of sorts. All these things, of course, cut both ways. That is, I used to think that when there was the Soviet Union, that we, who had vast freedom of speech, didn't care anything about the things that, the literature that we published, whereas the people in the Soviet Union who were not allowed to publish things treasured each little samizdat thing that came through, and it made a huge difference to them. So it's not a total plus to have freedoms. Freedom was not a concept that I had in my mind when I was writing this book. Love was a concept I had in my mind. I was thinking about the different kinds of love and the kinds of love you have for your friends, the kinds of love that are across gender but don't involve sex, the kind of love that does involve sex, the kind of sex that doesn't involve love. All of that was much more at the forefront of my mind than freedoms.
But the interesting thing about this book is that you have characters who are attracted to each other and who love each other for being honest, which I found to be quite, which kind of sort of works with this freedom angle I'm going with here.
I see what you mean. Yeah. Yes, I agree with you.
I mean, it's not always that simple.
Right, that's a very that's a very psychological notion of freedom. Yeah. That is, free to say what you think.
Yeah.
It's not something the government legislates about in personal relations, but it is a certain sort of freedom. That's right.
Well, it seems
that,
also...
of course, is not something that has increased over time. Mm-hmm. That is, if you read the Bloomsbury journals... I think they're all creeps, basically, except Leonard Wolf. But they were very proud of themselves for what they could say to each other in the circle of their friendship. That was a big part of what defined themselves to themselves, that they were free to say anything they wanted to each other. So we're talking about, you know, 1915 or so.
Yeah. Well, even so, though, I mean, you have the, like the whole letter that, that where the character reveals that he's, you know, potentially sleeping around in the third part. And basically it's that sort of honesty which is both, you know, it's permitted but at the same time it compromises the love in question. What does love mean to you? And why do you think that the honesty freedom sort of question seems to be tied into it so inherently?
Mm-hmm.
And there are other factors to it, you know. It's
yeah, and that same character who jeopardizes the relationship by revealing the truth in that letter redeems the relationship by coming back at the end and telling the truth about how he felt all along. So, frankly, that's all borrowed from reality. There was no intellectualizing going on. There was no saying, I need to prove a point here. I just took from experience. But it is a good question you're raising, and I guess I think another thing that I did not put into the book except a brief allusion. Harold's crazy and he has to go get sent off to a halfway house. It says run on pseudo-Langian principles.
Do you have to get that?
We don't have to get it, but is it going to mess this up?
No. I cut and paste. There's a phone ringing in the Three Penny Review offices.
Let's hope it's not an extremely personal message that comes out on the answering machine or you'll have to...
I can edit it out.
You'll have to
edit
it out. But what I was going to say is at the time, in the mid-1970s, there was R.D. Lang and he was saying... everything would be better if everybody was honest with each other all the time. And crazy people are more noble and, in fact, saner than...
I got your email and, yeah, all of that.
This is my friend.
Okay.
But, what was he going to say? I opened up, meaning I've canceled absence. So if you want, we can go there tomorrow. I didn't feel the same call. I could cancel and make a reservation. I don't even know what time it would be for.
This is Arthur to whom the book is dedicated.
Oh, really?
I'll see you later.
We can discuss him later. Yes. But anyway, I did not think R.D. Lang was right. I thought that crazy people are crazy, and saying too much truth is a problem. That's a sign of insanity, not sanity. But I thought that it was an issue. I thought that it was very important to see how far honesty could go before it became craziness or destructiveness or whatever else was a problem in that way. Certainly it's always an issue in relationships, and it was an issue in that the first book's relationships.
Yeah.
Who was telling the truth to who else about what? That was part of what made us judge whether the relationship was a full one or not.
Yeah, the other thing I want to talk to you, the playing with perspective that's in the first part, I find that interesting. We sort of see a conscious effort by the narrator to sort of commingle with these two time periods. And so certainly the time travel idea that we were talking about earlier, with Charlotte sort of going, you know, to and fro and kind of gradually revealing things and then, you know, we're kind of putting the pieces together and then at the end we finally figure it out. But in the other two episodes of the book, we don't necessarily have anything that is along those lines of that type of perspective, that sort of really super introspection. And I was wondering if you could sort of explain why that might be.
Okay. I thought it would be more apparent to us what was going on in 1956, 1975. It's closer to us. We don't need a sort of, you know how in science fiction there's always the Virgil, the guy that takes you through and interprets for you what's going on in the utopia. So we don't need that kind of person so much in 56 and 75 because it's closer to us. But also because I was doing something with style, with literary style. And in the first one, I'm writing in Henry James's style. Mm-hmm. And anyone who's read Henry James recognizes this when they start those first 8 pages. It's not necessary to have read Henry James to read this book at all. But if you have...
It also felt very much like Wharton, too.
Right. And so you're suddenly in this very heavy style. And I thought, people will die if they have to go through a whole third of a book in this mode. Now, it's one thing if you love Henry James and you read his old stuff, but it's another if somebody's doing it now. So I thought, I have to cut this style with a more direct voice. And so I use Charlotte speaking in the first person 25 years later in some ways to give like the sherbet course in between the two heavy courses of the meal, you know, to make you able to go on with that next section of the heavy Jamesian sentences because you'd had the refreshment of the direct first person voice in a more recent, you know, I don't know what, late Edith Wharton period mode. But I was also interested in the idea of turning experience into fiction, because that's what I was doing in part three.
Yeah.
And so I used what I had learned from what I'd done in part three. In other words, I am at the distance now from the events in part three that Charlotte was in 1926 from the events in 1901. That's sort of coincidental because this was written over such a long period.
Yeah.
But I was kind of aware of that distance that I felt from the part three events, and I wanted to incorporate that in what Charlotte was doing in part one and have some of that experience that I was having as an author conveyed through part one, where they are the most explicit authors, really,
yes.
Charlotte and Roderick. I mean, Sarah Jameson's called a novelist, but we don't really ever get to see any novelistic aspect
of
her. Yeah,
that's another thing I wanted to bring up, too. Yeah. It was like, for all these so-called writers and novelists, we don't actually see any kind of excerpt of their work. Well, you know.
Well, it would be boring, you know. I mean, A.S. Byatt doesn't think it's boring, and she gives us the contents, but for the most part, I find it very boring when you actually have to read through the works that the fictional writers have written.
I don't know. At the same time, like, for example, like Gilbert Sorrentino in his books, he always has these really adorable lists that populate out of nowhere. And I it sort of gives you this extra sort of, it gives you the feel, it gets you just sort of cemented in that particular world sometimes.
I'm sure that's true. For me, because I've spent so many years in the world of literary criticism, which I was trained in and which I practice myself, to me it signifies quotation from the text. In other words, here we come with a big blodge of text that's going to prove the point. You know, in some way, it makes my brain freeze over and turn into the critical mode. It's antithetical to the fiction mode, in my mind, just because it's so associated with literary criticism.
Really? So, that's interesting. So you're not one to necessarily, at least in your fiction writing, you're not one to really sort of, I guess, play postmodern tricksies on the reader.
I'm not, and I'm shocked at the extent to which this book has turned out to be even anything remotely like that. It's not a sort of book I ever thought I would write in that way. I'm a really old-fashioned, start at the beginning, get
Henry
to the
James,
end.
Yeah.
Henry James, all the 19th century novelists, I love them. They're much sharper and more sophisticated and less naive than modern theory would have them be. You know, they're all often commenting on the process of writing and on you reading and all that.
Yeah.
But they do believe in a coherent plot and things that have an ending and all that. And I've violated all that here. And I'm not ashamed of myself exactly. There's nothing that could be done about it. But I'm a little bemused that I didn't write the kind of book that I really love to read.
That's interesting. Well, at the same time, plotting is also very... This is a very plotted sort of book.
Plotted yes. Out. Well, that's certainly true. I mean, especially part one.
Yeah.
Because I wanted it to... I did start with the death of Queen Victoria and the events that happened with Henry James and his servants and the affair that Edith Wharton had with Morton Fullerton. These are all real things.
Yeah.
They all occurred at different times. I wanted them all to occur during the same week. Mm-hmm. And so I started with that cluster of events. And then I wanted there to be revelations of secrets. For me, that's always the most interesting part of a novel. So I had to construct the secrets. And I did, one of the stuffed away books in a drawer is a mystery.
Oh,
you know,
really?
I read mysteries all the time, and I love mysteries, good mysteries, but the one I tried to write was terrible. But so that notion that a book needs to have its layers uncovered in that way and gradually reveal information to the reader, I liked that. And I wanted that to be the case. And that was certainly the case in part one, in book one.
So, that's interesting. So that might also explain, because mysteries are also very heavily plotted, too.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think a plot is a hard thing to do. I have actually, in the next issue of the Threepenny Review, the winter issue, a symposium on plot. I've asked 8 or 9 writers to talk about plot and what they think about plot and why they like it or don't like it. Just because I think it's kind of an underattended thing in modern literature. People don't make explicit how they feel about plot except to say they hate it.
Yeah, okay.
And one of the writers says they say that because it's too hard.
Okay. I know you have to get ready at some point soon, so I'll ask you one last question.
This is really fun. You're a great interview.
Well, thank you. I also wanted to sort of kind of, I was trying to allude to it earlier, but in terms of how did your editing of the Three Penny Review cross over to the writing of the Pagoda?
Very little, in the sense that I had to inhibit my editorial critical faculty just to get stuff down on the page as fiction. The kind of fiction that I take for the Three Penny Review, frankly, I think is much better than I'm capable of writing. I mean, I have very high standards in what I read, and I really want it to be very good in the magazine, and much of it is by, you know, big name writers. I mean, Kinzaburo Oi and Javier Marias and people who are really big deals. And so in order not to castigate myself every paragraph that it wasn't up to that level, I just had to turn off that function and write the books the way they were, those three parts. And then the Three Penny editor came into play in the tinkering that came afterwards, in the making them relate to each other more, in the ordering of them, in thinking about how can I make this character reflect that one more than I have. So that the first level of it was much more unconscious and just let's write it and not have the sentence sound too ugly. Uh-huh. And the later level was more piecing together and making them connect. And then the final level of editing that I did with Harry was extremely, that was me and Harry talking on a professional level. You know, we're both editors, we both know these pieces of advice are good, I should follow them, that kind of thing.
So there wasn't really, it seems, much conflict between Wendy, the literary critic, and the editor in terms of actually the revision of this book, I guess.
I didn't feel there was, although at the reading I gave at Black Oak the other night, somebody asked this question, had myself as a critic interfered with myself as a fiction writer? And I said I didn't feel that because most of my criticism tends to be directed outward at other people, not at myself. But then afterwards I realized it probably accounts for the fact that it took me 25 years to write one novel. In other words, it was an inhibiting factor, but not necessarily a directly influential factor.
Well, I don't want you to be late. So, Wendy, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much for coming out here and doing this.
Sure, no problem.